supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Can we get your pronunciation of the word Scranton?
Oh, really? Scranton?
No, it's not Scranton. I pronounce it Scranton.
How do you say it?
I say Scranton because when I was in college, everyone knew we were from Scranton because we used to say Scranton.
How do you pronounce
it? Say Scranton.
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 I'm Naomi Starobin, and this is Grapple.
Every city's facing exactly what Scranton is. It's not unique. You know, everybody's got all these struggles that are going on. You know, business, money, politics. It's all over. Middle class. You know, that's what's most disturbing now is that we've lost that middle class.
Kathy Gavin spent nearly 50 years in North Scranton, and she remembers how bustling the area once was with lots of different businesses all around Providence Square.
Starting on this side of the street, I'm talking about Climax, I'm talking about the Toscano's Barbershop, then I'm talking to Sterner's, and then the liquor store was here, and then the Taurus Club was there, and then there was Trader's, Vince Shoe Store, Bill's Sporting Goods, the Belmont, which ended up being Strazzeri's after that. Now you come around, let alone the library, then you're talking Warren Leonard's, then you're coming up, you have Furman's. You have McDonald's Jewelers. You had Cotton Gilbride's, the bar, you know, these little neighborhood bars on every corner. This was so alive, you have no idea. Every single one of them, I mean, we were busy.
Gavin herself owns a business on Providence Square. It's a restaurant called Sterna's, and she's had to make changes over the years to stay open.
You know, we closed lunches in 95, which they thought I was crazy, but because all the businesses were gone. So we didn't have that lunch trade. And we knew that there was a traffic out there for catering, whether it be funerals or whatever. You just have to be changing all the time. Certainly you know that. Or now you're done.
The restaurant is somewhat of a local institution. And actually, our reporter, Eleanor Klibnoff, used to go there when she was younger.
Every time I'd visit my grandparents, Camp G&G, we'd go to Sterna's, which is known for many things, including their famous old-fashioned. But I always knew it as the only place I ever got to eat fried shrimp, which they still sell, according to Kathy Gavin.
Besides the fried shrimp, Eleanor really does have a personal connection to North Scranton. Her mother, Laurie Leonard, grew up there, and her grandfather, Warren Leonard, owned a pharmacy right on Providence Square. It was called Leonard's. And here's what Eleanor's mother remembers about growing up in the business.
So when we were little, we'd go exploring in the basement and stuff. There would be old spindles of prescriptions and the old bottles of stuff that they used to use. I mean, in the days before antibiotics even, and he had so many interesting, weird tinctures of this and tinctures of that. And, you know, everything was written in the Latin names and these old traditional glass apothecary bottles. And I started working in the store like on Saturday afternoons and, you know, ringing the cash register, or making money orders for people, or, you know, it was really fun to do. But really the fun was delivering the prescriptions. So rain or snow, I mean, we learned how to drive in terrible weather because when the weather was bad, people really wanted their medicine delivered. They didn't want to come to the store for it. So, you know, how Scranton is so hilly and those tiny narrow streets would be, you know, skidding down the streets in a little VW bug trying to deliver the prescriptions. And people would give you a quarter or 50 cents for a tip. It was, and my father would always say, no, don't take that tip because, you know, it's our business. Like the non-family members could take a tip.
Her father ran the pharmacy for many years and ended up selling back in 1991.
As time went on, my father, you know, the luster wore off that because things changed a lot. You know, just kind of the chain drugstores started coming in and they bought up a lot of independent pharmacies. They had bigger stores and they had bigger volume, so they had bigger, you know, they could have lower prices. There was just a lot more, you know, regulations and stuff that just kind of would wear people down. But so the square started losing business. Some of those old-time stores, you know, just started closing. There were empty buildings. That's never a good thing. Then, you know, things got a little crummier. My father had a couple break-ins and robberies. So that was kind of hard. And the square just really fell on hard times.
All these years later, Leonard's Pharmacy is still there. So Eleanor stopped by, and she chatted with the manager, Joe Marquez. He told her about how business is steady, mainly because customers still want delivery. And he also talked about how North Scranton has changed over the last 25 years.
Sorry for my cold hands.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, we are here to talk to you a little bit about the pharmacy. And
okay.
You've got a couple minutes now? That's still a good time?
Yeah, come on over here.
As I mentioned, my grandfather was Warren Leonard.
Okay.
I'm Laurie's daughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So we want to talk a little bit about the pharmacy back when Warren owned it.
Okay.
And sort of what the area looked like then, and when you bought, what North Scranton looked like when you bought it.
Mm-hmm. As you can see, the neighborhood really is, like, we've lost most of our businesses here. It's terrible. 25 years ago, I mean, there were every business was booming, you know. Foot traffic was great and squared everything that people would need without having to drive. We had post office, doctors, supplies, pharmacies, funeral home. It was everything you needed.
Yeah, what changed, do you think?
Well, the advent of all the Kmarts and the Walmarts. There were two dress factories in the square. Lunchtime, we had a lot of foot traffic. We used to sell money orders and stamps, and it was different.
Yeah. So, is there any way we could go down to the basement? My mom was telling me that, and you can tell me if this is still there. So, my mom was telling me that when she was a kid working behind the counter, and they still used the paper prescriptions, and they would put it like on the spike.
You want to see? I'll take you down now. You want to go down?
Can
now?
We go down and see it? Okay.
Just be careful here.
Okay. Yeah, so my mom was saying they would put the prescription on a spike, and that was like your records. It was just pinning it. Oh. This is awesome. Like, look at this in here. You can see the signatures on them. Oh, my God.
Put them on these.
So doctors never had good handwriting. Is that what I'm getting?
Some of these, 1945.
Yeah, she remembered ones back to the 1800s. Like, they would go back and say, you know.
There might have been older ones, like, except they could have got thrown out or destroyed. Your grandfather was here about 35 years, 30 years, and then before him was McDonald's, and they were here for a good 35 years, and before that it was Kirkendall.
Okay.
And they were here for about 25 to 35 years, and there was one before him, so now we're going back into 1800s.
After Eleanor visited the pharmacy, she passed by the house where her grandparents used to live and where her mother grew up. The house sits along a block of homes up high on a hill, kind of overlooks the city. It's a grand view of a place that was once home to 140,000 people back at its peak around 1930. Whereas today, the population is half that. People like Eleanor's mother left Scranton and didn't come back. And over the years, some big companies have left the area too, as local business leader Dave Hawk recalls.
The lead company of this area at one time, and I'm going back to maybe the 70s, was a company by the name of International Salt. And they made road salt. Well, they mined it. They didn't make it. Great jobs because they were headquartered here. They sold to Axo Salt, and they remained here as a presence. And then they ended up selling Axo to a Dutch company that actually ended up closing everything here. And that business does not exist. There's not a remnant left. There's not a square foot of office space. There's not an employee of that business anymore. And yet, at one time, that was one of the biggest employers and one of the most important ones because of the good jobs.
Hawk owns Gertrude Hawk Chocolates, which his grandmother started, and today the business mostly makes inclusions, those little bits of chocolate in ice cream like Ben & Jerry's fish food. Hawk told Eleanor why he's kept the business in Scranton, and he also talked about some of the changes he's seen over the years.
Well, I guess I got to start with a confession. I like chocolate, but I'm not nuts about it. So therefore, would I... I like chocolate. But if you're going to give me chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream, I'm going to eat vanilla ice cream.
I hope you know we're recording all of this.
No, I mean, I do like the chocolate, but I'm not saying I didn't say I didn't like it.
What does it mean to Scranton or to the region to have Gertrude Hawk based here?
I think there's three aspects to that question. First of all, we're locally owned. And why is that important? I think it's important because every area, the bedrock of their economy, is locally owned because the center of the company is there. The philanthropy, if there's a philanthropy thought in the company, is based in that community. The best jobs for the company are there. And so I think there's a second part to that, and that is, being that we're locally owned, we're not going to move away. We're family owned and have no interest in being anything other than that, so we're not going to sell to whoever. So we have an interest in nurturing another generation. And then, of course, there's the jobs. And we employ, give or take, 600 people in manufacturing. I mean, we're not General Motors, but at the same time, it's a number of jobs. And I think, again, that's important to the community.
Do you think there are job opportunities for people in Scranton these days?
Are there job opportunities? Sure. Could they be better? You can believe it. We have turned out, over a number of years, a lot of well-educated folks, and they leave the area, most of them, or a lot of them. And it's because those good jobs that they're looking for are not available or are hard to find. And frankly, are filled with folks that love living here, and so they're not going to move.
From a business perspective, how do you feel like Scranton has changed?
It's amazing to me the number of immigrants we've attracted. This was a town that was a white, working class community. And I mean, today you walk through our plant and you see Hispanics, you see Asians, you see Indians, all kinds of people that, you know, it's amazing to me. They don't want to leave where they were. They're here because this is the dream. Not Scranton, I don't mean, but the American dream, to make something, to be able to live a life.
It turns out many immigrants new to Scranton often first move to the city's south side. There's a growing Hispanic and Indian community there. Eleanor met Rita Patel. Her family moved to Scranton about 10 years ago, and today they own two businesses. One is a restaurant, and the other is a convenience store that also carries Indian groceries. So let's hear some of Eleanor's conversation with Patel at her store.
So how long have you lived in Scranton?
Almost 10 years.
Where were you before?
North Carolina.
So you went to North Carolina first?
Yeah. North Carolina is good, but, you know, there is no job. So my friend told me Scranton is good, job opportunity is good. That's why we came over here. I working like 4 years in TJ Maxx. Yeah.
Working like in the store or in the...
Warehouse.
Oh, the warehouse.
Warehouse,
okay.
Yeah.
Do you like the city? Is it a good place to live?
I think it's a Scranton. It's a good city. Cheaper and it's more comfortable for everybody. No crime. Mostly, people, it's very nice and very helpful.
Do you think your children will want to come work for the business after high school or move elsewhere?
No. And they don't want to, do the hard work, you know, and this one is too hard for them. So I told them, if you guys get a good education, so I don't like either, they do hard work.
As we just heard, Patel mentioned that Scranton is affordable and that crime is not an issue. And those two factors have really become selling points for immigrants who are moving into Scranton. Eleanor spoke with Gus Fahey about these trends and about the prevailing attitudes around immigrants in Scranton. Fahey is in charge of community and revitalization for the United Neighborhood Centers of Northeastern Pennsylvania.
For the recent immigrants that you work with, where are they mainly coming from?
About half of our people that come into the center are from Latin America. The other half is all over the place. Scranton is one of those small cities that is a place for resettling refugees. So we have a large South Asian population. We have a Middle Eastern population. We have an African population that's increasing. So where we were traditionally a community that hosted immigrants from Europe primarily, now we're sort of expanding our vision to being a place that welcomes immigrants from all over the world.
Generally, what is the relationship between maybe more longtime Scrantonians and the immigrant newcomers?
I would say it's mixed. And this is, again, sort of more anecdotally what I hear from people that I've known growing up and then seeing what people say. But the immigrants report that their experiences are very good. And on the other hand, I hear what white people say amongst themselves. And I know this sort of, there's an undercurrent of resentment or that people are cheating somehow. You know, they're not waiting in line or they're not working hard enough. I also think that there's this conflation between this long decline in Scranton and then these cultural changes that are happening at the same time. And so people see their neighborhood declining and they associate it with a new face. And I think that's a shame because it undercuts sort of a solution to the economic decline that we suffered for 6 or 7 decades leading up to this century.
Do you think this anti-immigrant sentiment that some people have, is it pervasive enough to sort of have an effect on Scranton's reputation amongst immigrants and that staying power that you're looking for?
I worry about it because I feel like there are a lot of people that think these bad things about immigrants, but don't necessarily say it, and don't necessarily say it in a public forum. And so when people in positions of power say it's okay to express this anger and this resentment, I worry that people that are here for the first time, that have been through a lot of trials to get here, won't find this to be a safe refuge for them. And I think that would be a real shame. Because for me, we need people that are going to bring their talents and their energy and their ideas, their perspectives about the world. These are all things that we don't have and that we need.
Not unlike the immigrants he works with, Fahey has his own migration story. He grew up in Scranton, he left for a while, but then he came back. And today, Fahey sees Scranton becoming really a more livable place than it used to be.
I think there's a more positive attitude than when I was growing up here. So I think in general, people are more hopeful about the future. As I said, since we had this 6 or 7 decade decline, and that really takes a toll on people's attitudes about the future. And when I first graduated from college, I had moved to Philadelphia, and I had come back for a 5-year reunion. And people say, oh, what are you doing? And all I said was that I'm living in Philadelphia. And it was like, oh, you got out. Your success, you know, terrific. And it didn't really matter what I was or wasn't doing in Philly. But that was sort of a prevailing attitude that, you know, get out while you can kind of thing. And I don't feel that now. I feel like the kind of people that I spend my time with see a lot of good in this place. And I do too. We're a small city that has low expenses and low crime. And that's sort of an unusual combination. And so you can live relatively cheaply here. Housing is abundant. So you can afford a house. You can buy a house for cheaper than it is to rent a place. The reason is we have a housing stock that's built for nearly twice the number of people that we have. So we really need people to come in and to want to stay and to fill up our houses, to renovate our houses, to shovel the sidewalks, you know, when it snows, to take a leadership role in sort of having neighbors act as a community. We need all that in Scranton.
Well, the way Fahey sees the city changing and what he thinks Scranton could become, that might have appealed to another Scranton native deeply concerned about cities, Jane Jacobs. She's considered one of the most influential urbanists ever. She was born in 1916. She grew up as Jane Butzner in an inner-ring suburb called Dunmore. Writer Glenna Lang is working on a new book about her. It's called Jane Jacobs' First City, Learning from Scranton, PA.
That was when Scranton was very much at its peak, and its downtown was absolutely bustling. It had beautiful department stores. It had a magnificent library. It had all sorts of industry. Its population was hugely diverse, and these were all things that she noticed and were important to her. And I believe that the city hugely influenced her and her thinking and was the basis for many of her ideas from the very beginning.
Lang says Scranton's decline really did have a big impact on Jacobs.
Jane became very aware of how city economies work, even as a teenager, because she saw the decline of the coal industry, and the industry was affected by less demand, and she saw that the city was too dependent on coal. So once coal was no longer sought after, the city just started to leech young people. And Jane was among the many that left because of that.
Jacobs moved away to New York City, where she successfully pursued her career as a writer. And over the years, Scranton was a topic she just continued to write about. As a matter of fact, during World War II, she wrote a nationally acclaimed piece in a trade journal called Iron Age about Scranton's weak economy.
She used her writing skills to draw attention to the problem and to try to bring industry, wartime industry, to Scranton. Because of her efforts, the Murray Corporation plant, came to Scranton and employed a huge number of people manufacturing bomber wings for airplanes in World War II.
Later on in her career, Jacobs produced many influential works, including the 1961 groundbreaking book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities.
Death and Life was a plea to people to appreciate what was good about cities and not to tear them down wholesale. If you read it carefully and think about it, you can certainly see that Scranton is kind of undergirding the book. And I think as she got older, she thought more and more about Scranton because she mentions it more in interviews and her books. She referred to it as her hometown and was very nostalgic about it.
And finally, many of you out there might simply know Scranton because of the TV show The Office. So we'll leave you with this quick bit from the show about Scranton's nickname, The Electric City.
They call it Scranton!
What?
The Electric City!
Scranton! What?
The Electric City!
Lazy Scranton, the Electric City! They call it that because of the electricity!
The city's laid out from east to west, and a public parking lot is a truly the best!
And that wraps up our show. Be sure to check out our photo essay about Scranton. It's online at keystonecrossroads.org/grapple. And if you're liking Grapple so far, please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. We really appreciate your support and we welcome your feedback. Next time on Grapple, we'll break down whether the American dream is still attainable with Harvard University political scientist Robert Putnam. He's the author of Bowling Alone and most recently, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Grapple is produced by Keystone Crossroads and Cuvenda Media. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to our reporters, Eleanor Klibanoff and Lindsay Lazarski, and WHYY's Charlie Kyer for engineering our show and his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marutis of Cuvenda Media, and I'm Naomi Sturobin, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.